Welcome to The Property Wizard. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Freddie Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the Property Wizard, Freddie.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Freddie and Bernie Show. Just as a quick recap, we've covered quite a bit, but we're going to start off today with doing something a little different. Bernie, I understand that we've received a few emails.
You've got mail. We got one from Christine. She notes, on a previous podcast, you talked about investment clubs. How much money do you need to get started in something like that?
Well, first of all, thank you, Christine, for your email. Great question. At the end of the day, it really depends on what your plans are as far as what it is you're contemplating buying. I've been involved in syndications that have had as little as $10,000 invested per co-tenant or partner, and all the way up to $250,000. So there's a real broad range. So there isn't any specific amount. It just depends. For instance, if you and your friends, let's say you have 5-6 friends, and you each have $20,000 to invest. Let's make it a nice round number, $100,000. Well, obviously, you're going to be restricted as far as your purchasing power is concerned to probably something along the lines, depending on where you live, to condominium or condominium townhouse, something maybe in the $350,000 to $500,000 range. There's a lot of factors that come into this. Very often, as I mentioned previously, what we're looking for are value-added opportunities. And sometimes you have a motivated seller who's willing to assist with the financing. That may mean that you don't have to put down as much as you normally would if you're looking for conventional financing. Or you may arrange conventional first mortgage and ask the seller to take back a small second. These are all things we'll get into a little further along. So the bottom line is, it depends. But like I said, I've had experiences with co-tenancies with where there's a $10,000 buy-in all the way up to $250,000. So there isn't any set amount. It's whatever you and your partners and friends feel comfortable investing. I hope that answers your question. Sorry, I couldn't be more specific, Christine.
This one's from Hamid. What is the difference between a co-tenancy and a syndication? It seems like the two mean the same thing.
Again, thank you very much for your email, Hamid. And it's a question that I'm asked a great deal because people tend to, it isn't a question of confusing the two. They're essentially synonymous. When you talk about a co-tenancy, you're talking about a syndication. It's just the term. Very often with a syndication, what governs that partnership is something called a co-tenancy agreement. And we have an entire podcast that is just going to focus just on that singular document. But at the end of the day, to try to elaborate a little more, a co-tenant is different from a joint tenant. And when we're talking about definitions, the first thing you have to understand is that there's a difference between co-tenancy or a co-tenant and a joint tenant. And I'm bringing joint tenancy in because there's really one major singular difference. A joint tenant are not two tenants that enjoy smoking joints together, contrary to what you might want to think. A joint tenant is determined, or the chief characteristic of a joint tenant is called right of survivorship. If you're married right now or have a significant other and you own a single family home, if one of you were to pass away, the other joint tenant receives the benefit or would inherit your property. With a co-tenancy, that's not the case. If you're part of a co-tenancy and something were to happen to you, your share of that property immediately goes to your estate. I often say this to people. A joint tenant, think of being joined at the hips. at the end of the day, if something happens to you, your significant other, your spouse, will receive your interest in that property. And a single family home is an excellent example of that. With a co-tenancy, again, there is no right of survivorship.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
So we're going to move into a slightly different section here called In the News. And, you know, I have the benefit of reading and seeing all sorts of articles from all across the country. I thought today I'd just like to, you know, do a quick Freddie's Notes on an article that I read that was written by Ansley Smith on stories.com. And I accessed this website through CREA's, the Canadian Real Estate Association's Read All About It headline section. There's a reason why I brought this article up. It talks about the most affordable cities to invest in or to buy a single family home, which, again, if you've listened to these broadcasts, I'm a strong believer that your first investment should, if you're so disposed, be your own residence. So at the end of the day, you know, she makes the comment that the demand for housing is, and currently and has in the past, grossly outweighed the supply. And that I think goes without saying. The average price of a home in Canada right now, according to this article, which is relatively recent, it was published on July 20th of this year of 2021, is $679,000. That represents an incredible 25.9% year over year increase. So one of the reasons why we've seen such an increase is because, again, demand has just grossly outweighed supply. So it goes on to list the most affordable to the least affordable cities. And in this article, she quotes RE/MAX Canada, who issued this report, ranked the cities in order of affordability. Now, this doesn't necessarily reflect housing costs for similar type housing from one city to the next. This is a ranking that's based on the average sale price and the monthly household income and the percentage allocated towards a mortgage. So from most affordable to least. Okay. So, you know, Toronto and Vancouver are easy. Those are the easy ones. So the ranking from most affordable to least, at the top of the list is St. John's. Second, very much with what it was you were saying, Regina. Third, Winnipeg. Fourth, Edmonton. Ottawa is ranked fifth as far as affordability is concerned.
Wow.
Yeah. Calgary, Windsor, London, that's London, Ontario. Ranked ninth is Oshawa, Durham. 10th, Hamilton. 11th, Kitchener, Waterloo. 12th, Brampton. And the top three, when ranked as being the least affordable, are Victoria, Toronto, and Vancouver. No real surprises there. But if you find yourself in one of these markets, what do you do? Well, I look at this in a slightly different light. And you know how fond I am of saying, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities. So what you may want to do is consider a few ownership alternatives. And one of the things that Ansley mentions, and it kind of echoes again my philosophy, is maybe you might want to consider renting out a portion of your primary residence. It's a great source of income. And we talked about that in one of the earlier podcasts where we were talking about what you can do and the, you know, if you have your own single family home and you want to pay it down a little quicker. That was one of the primary ideas that we tossed around, you and I. Another thing that you can do is maybe pool your finances with friends or other family members to purchase a home. There are certain demographics that do that, and it works wonderfully well where the family pulls together and buys a home. And once that home is paid for and is being purchased, the family pools together again and buys another home. So I think that's an incredible, well-proven way to turn around and get your foot in the real estate door, particularly if you're buying, again, a single-family residence. So the reason why, again, I brought this up was because, you know, it's not a question of woe is me. I live in one of these markets where housing is just not affordable. There are ways that you can circumvent or work with that. All right. So why don't we get on to the podcast topic? And that's an introduction to property management, really geared towards managing the property yourself. So the real point that I want to make here is that there isn't another factor that can or will affect the value of your property, the value of your investment. There's no other factor more prevalent than property management. You know, a good property manager can turn the worst managed property or the worst property into one of the most desirable properties. But it all works under the premise that you've got or you have the experience to manage the property yourself. And that's a question you really have to ask yourself, because property management can be very demanding and it can be very time consuming. So you need to ask yourself the question, should I manage the property myself? So there's a whole lot of factors here. If you're renting a unit or a room in your home, it's a pretty easy exercise to manage the property yourself. You're there. Most of the issues that a tenant or occupant may have are probably going to be the same issues that you have or had, and they're pretty easily addressed. Now, exponentially, if you move outside your home and move into maybe a duplex as a secondary investment or triplex, a commercial plaza, of course, the problems are going to become a little less easy to deal with. Do you have any idea what some of those problems might be, Bernie?
I think it depends on what you're servicing, right? If it's the electrical, you need an electrician, right? So if you might have to be licensed for some of the tasks. If you're redoing a roof, I don't know if I want to be on the rooftop and learning how to play a role.
Good point. Very, very good point. So, you know, again, it's your experience level. How much experience do you have in, you know, doing those repairs yourself? Some people are very handy. Some people aren't so handy. So it's going to depend on the number of units that you have, the location of those units, the type of the units. You know, there's a big difference between managing a room in your home and managing a rooming house. And there's a further difference between managing a rooming house and managing a building with 2, 3, 6 or more units. There are huge differences in all this. So big difference on the type of unit that you own. And the other thing that you have to kind of keep in mind is you have to ask yourself whether your goals have changed. It could be that you started off with maybe renting a room in your home, bought a triplex, decided to branch out more, maybe purchased another triplex or maybe a 6 unit. And now you've really started to invest and look for other opportunities. But it could be that what was a very modest goal has now changed. And now you'd like to add other property to your portfolio. Well, particularly if you have a full-time job, it's a little difficult to take care of all that yourself. So your goals may have changed too. And you may not be able to handle or deal with just the most basic of paperwork when it comes to dealing with, you know, your real estate portfolio. But that's not a bad thing. It's just recognizing that maybe things have changed a bit. So what we're going to do is just go through some of the responsibilities that you'll have to take care of if you're managing a home yourself. Of course, the most obvious that you're going to have collect and deposit your rents. Now, very often today, most tenants actually prefer to pay by electronic deposit, you know, e-transfer, that type of thing. So it's less of a problem today than it was in the past, but it's still something that you have to keep track of. You're going to have to deal with lease-ups. You're going to have to deal with terminations. And one of the things that you can do, that a professional manager will do on your behalf, but what you can do yourself is find efficiencies. You can do things like change the light bulbs to, you know, low voltage bulbs. You can try to, if you have a number of different units, maybe negotiate a different price with the person doing your lawn maintenance or snow removal if they take care of both properties. Little things like that will make a huge difference to your bottom line. Of course, one of the more unpleasant things you have to deal with is dealing with disruptive behavior and vandalism, because that can occur.
Do you do periodic walkthroughs? If someone spray paints the side of your structure, your building, you don't live near the building, how do you know?
Well, usually, and one of the things that I like doing, and we're going to speak about that during our next podcast when we're talking about professional management, it's always nice to maintain a good rapport with your tenants. And chances are that, you know, if a tenant comes home and actually notices or sees that somebody is spray painted or there's a maintenance issue that you may not be immediately aware of, you'll probably hear something back from your tenant or tenants. That's not uncommon. But what I always do, whether we're managing a property for a third party or whether it's one of our own, is I schedule regular visits. I do that. I may decide on a Friday afternoon to make a tour and I'll go visit, do drive-bys at least to various properties. You can't do it each and every week, but I personally and members of my staff do this, you know, on a regular basis, because it's really important to know what's happening within your building and your investment. So this way, if you're managing the property for a third party, you can say, yes, we visited the site last Thursday and everything appeared to be fine. Now, if it's your own property, I think there's a certain level of comfort in actually going by, taking a look at your assets and making sure everything is as it should be. So I schedule regular visits. Doesn't have to be every week, can be every 2 weeks, maybe even once a month. But again, I would always suggest that what you do is you leave an open door policy with the tenant, in the sense that if the tenant is the person living there, so, you know, if you've got a good rapport with one or several of your tenants, you'll hear for sure if there's an issue. If you invite them to send you an email or call you and say, look, you know, this happened, or, you know, this needs some attention. I mean, I know a lot of you right now are rolling your eyes. It's the very reason why you don't want to invest in real estate. But really, it doesn't have to be that way. You don't have to have an adversarial, or, you know, no one needs to take an aggressive position. Most tenants, the majority of them, are relatively easy to work with. So I think it's important that you develop a good rapport with your tenants. They're the ones there. They're living on the premises day after day after day. So rest assured, if there's a burnt out light bulb or there's something that requires immediate fix, you'll probably hear it from them. But the other thing to make your job easier is developing a team. You know, if you are going to invest in real estate, I can't emphasize enough that you need to develop relationships with members of your team. People that are going to make your ownership journey a lot easier. Who do you think should be on that team? Who would you think that you'd have to rely on, Bernie?
Well, let's see. Pest control, because we touched on that earlier. Groundskeeping around the place. Probably a carpenter, electrician, painter, drywaller, flooring expert.
Yeah.
And that's just the physical maintenance. And, you know, it goes from there, then the professional services too, right?
Absolutely. You are 100% on. So, you know, you've got, and I always recommend that, you know, you have a primary plumber on speed dial, but you also have, you know, secondary individuals that, just in case your plumber isn't immediately available, you have somebody else that you can access, or your plumber tends to be on holidays or anything along those lines. You know, you should develop a relationship with a primary plumber, an electrician, a painter, appliance repair techs. Open up an account with a reputable appliance repair supplier. And as they get to know you, they can, in many cases, even save you money. They're the ones who are going to be best qualified to say, look, it's worthwhile spending the money on this, or it isn't. but a good appliance repair company person can save you all sorts of grief, all sorts of grief. So keep that in mind. Very important. So plumbers, electricians, appliance repair techs, painters. If you're not much of a painter yourself, get the name of a couple of painters. You know, suppliers, again, open up accounts, not just with your chosen appliance repair firm, but for with flooring suppliers, you know, maintenance suppliers. You're going to need, as you said, carpenters. I'll suggest general contractors, regular maintenance personnel. And again, remember, when you're dealing with maintenance in particular, there may be some economies of scale to be had here. You know, you might be able to find or a certain efficiency in having your maintenance personnel. And I'm talking about maybe cleaners, you know, your grass cutters or exterior maintenance people, whether it's snow or grass or gardening. You know, if they have, you know, two or three different buildings of yours, chances are that as a package, that'll be less expensive for you than doing them individually with different contractors. And of course, you need professionals too. You need a lawyer when you're buying the property and for any tenant related issues that you don't feel comfortable or you're not able to resolve yourself. And of course, let's not forget about the real estate professional. It may very well be in particular markets that the most effective way to fill your unit if there's a vacancy is to use your local real estate agent. Not all agents deal with rentals, but many do. And very often, if you're coming in from out of town, the first thing someone is going to do is call up a local real estate agent just to find out the neighborhoods, you know, what the characteristics of certain neighborhoods are. Maybe they've got young children and schooling is an issue. And the best source for that, if you're not able to do it yourself, is a real estate agent. So don't forget them. Always good to have at least one on board, one that can help you with the leasing, and more importantly, one that can help you find the opportunities as they arrive. So wonderful, super. So I think that's it, unless you have something else you want to add to the discussion.
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
Yes, Word of the Day, drum roll. What's the Word of the Day today, Bernie?
Actually, it's two words, base rent.
You know, we just finished talking about additional rent, you know, the factors and things that make up additional rent to some extent, all these other maintenance costs and everything else, which are recoverable when you're dealing with a commercial tenant. Well, base rent is a term that you'll hear when dealing with a commercial tenancy. And essentially, there are two components to the rental payment when it comes to any type of a commercial tenancy. And you'll hear it kind of quoted like this. They'll say the base rent is X number of dollars, say $15 per square foot. And then they'll say the additional rent is blank. It could be $15, $16, it could be $20, $25 per square foot. So essentially, base rent is the rent that you're paying for the actual physical space that you're occupying, absent the expenses that are incurred or paid for by the landlord for that same space. So what will end up happening is that you'll have a commercial tenant that, let's say, rents 1,000 square feet at $20 per square foot. To make a very, and it doesn't need to be complicated at all, but that rent of $20 per square foot can be the same for a five-year term. It could be that the tenant and landlord have come to terms and the tenant is going to pay, you know, the base amount of $20 per square foot for the entire five-year term. Now, additional rent are the expenses, again, that are related, and they're quoted on a per square foot basis. And essentially what happens is that the expenses that are incurred in the operation of the building are taken as a whole and divided by the number of square feet. By doing that, you establish a per square foot cost related to the operation of the building. So what ends up happening is that your base rent may be the same for a five-year term, but your additional rent could start off at $15 per square foot, but over the course of a five-year term, as expenses increase, and they're generally adjusted at the beginning of every calendar year, it could go from $15, $16, $17 per square foot. So you add the two to get your total effective rent.
Okay.
But the reason why it's separated is because the expenses will increase every year, or usually increase every year. So it's not to the landlord's benefit to turn around and fix the rent at a certain amount, because what will end up happening is that those expenses, the additional rent portion of their total rent, will generally increase. So, you know, you may have a base rent of $20, but your additional rent will be adjusted every year. So does that make any difference? Again, I've kind of gone off on a tangent, but it's difficult to speak about base rent without speaking about additional rent.
You wouldn't see that in residential though, right?
Usually what happens with residential, it's pretty clear cut. You know, you don't rent an apartment, for instance, on a per square foot basis. It may very well be that they've established the rent in that way. But generally speaking, you're going to pay X number of dollars for the apartment, and that's going to include the landlord's portion of expenses are factored into what it is you're paying. That means the landlord isn't going to come back to you and say, okay, the property taxes are X number of dollars. You need to pay me so much more. It doesn't work that way. What you do find is essentially a gross, in this particular case, it's gross rent. You're paying a gross amount, which includes things like the building insurance, the property management, property taxes, and usually the outside maintenance as well, unless there's another arrangement made to occupy that premise when you're a tenant. But you may be responsible for things, of course, that are consumables, things that vary according to the demand or the amount that you use, such as gas and hydro. You know, those are the two most prevalent ones. So you can expect to see a lease that says it's X number of dollars plus utilities.
Okay.
And those utilities are usually specified, but you're not going to find a situation where you've got base rent amount and then an additional rent amount in a residential application. You're not going to do that. So, all right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. That's a great question, Bernie. Thank you so much for that. On our next podcast, we're going to talk about professional property management, what to expect, what you can expect to pay, and the various things and equities that can be had by hiring a professional property management company, and more importantly, when to do that. So I think that's it for today. I want to remind everybody that you can save $250 on your next Gentry Learning course by using the phrase podcast when checking out. There's a great investment course that we have available online. It's specifically tailored to those with little or no real estate investment experience. And by using the phrase podcast, you can save $250 on that course. Great course. We've had a lot of success with it. Take a look at the splash page. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for subscribing. And remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities. Till next time, take care.
Thanks for joining Freddie on another edition of The Property Wizard. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentryres.com. Until next time, remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.